And welcome to another edition of Book Talk. I'm Stephen Usry, and I'm pleased to welcome Candace Millard to the program today. Millard is a former writer and editor for the National Geographic magazine. Her first book, The River of Doubt, Theodore Roosevelt's Darkest Journey, was published in 2005. Destiny of the Republic, A Tale of Madness, Medicine, and the Murder of a President, which won an Edgar Award for Best Fact Crime Book, followed in 2011. Doubleday has recently published her third book, Hero of the Empire, The Boer War, A Daring Escape, and the Making of Winston Churchill, which has already spent several weeks in the top 10 of the New York Times bestseller list. Candace, you start off the book with Churchill's escape as a prisoner of war during the Second Boer War. And at that moment, when he gets out of the camp, he seems to be like the dog who caught the car. He's, what's next?
Exactly. You know, I think that he was shocked to find himself in this situation. When he was first captured, his first thoughts were of escape. He was desperate to get out of this situation. He hated being a captive. He was determined to get back to the war, where he thought there would be all these opportunities for gallantry and adventure. But he didn't really have a plan. His original plans had been, you know, being Winston Churchill, his original plans had been these sort of grandiose things where he thought, I'm going to take over the whole prison, and then I'm going to take over the prison where they're keeping the soldiers, and then I'm going to take over the whole town, Pretoria, which was the capital of the Boers, and I'm going to capture the president of the Boers, and I'm going to end the war. So there's very, very grandiose plans. But instead, he overheard some friends who were planning something very different, something very simple and quiet. They found that at night, when the electric lights came on, there was a corner of the prison yard that was still dark. And they thought if the armed guards had turned their backs, they could get over the fence, which was about 6.5 feet tall.
Who were the two men that he had made this plan with?
So one was a man named Elmer Halden, who had been an old friend of his. Halden was fighting, actually, in the war. Churchill was just a correspondent. But he had been in the military before, and they'd known each other then. And Halden felt that he was the reason Churchill had been captured. They had been on this armored train together. And Halden had invited Churchill along. The other man was a man named Adam Brockie, who was this very unusual guy. He was very scrappy. He had been in South Africa for quite a while. He knew the terrain very well. He spoke Afrikaans, the language of the Boers. He spoke Zulu. So he was really, really useful. He was a very, very useful guy, and Halden knew it. And when they came up with this plan, Halden and Brockie together, the last person they wanted to take along was Winston Churchill.
He had a big mouth.
He had a very big mouth, and they knew it. And when Churchill told them he wanted to get in on their plan, they said, absolutely not. You talk too much. You're going to tell everybody. You're too famous. He was the son of Lord Randolph Churchill, who'd been the Chancellor of the Exchequer, the leader of the House of Commons. And so he was too famous. They knew that he would be noticed right away if he were missing. And they didn't think that he was strong enough. They had to go from Pretoria to what was then Portuguese East Africa, almost 300 miles of enemy territory. And Churchill hadn't been exercising or any of that, taking care of himself while they had been imprisoned. And they didn't want to have to drag him along. So they said, no, there's no way. We're not taking you. But then Halden had second thoughts. He felt guilty. Churchill was his friend. He thought it was his fault Churchill was captured. So he said, look, you know we don't want you to come, but I will leave it up to you. And Churchill, being Churchill again, said, I'm coming. So these guys were sort of forced into letting him come along. And then it turns out only Churchill gets over the fence. He gets over quickly. He's waiting for an hour in the bushes right on the other side of the fence at great, great risk to himself. And the other guys can't get over. The guards see them attempting. So he's stuck. But he doesn't have anything. They have all the provisions. He doesn't have a map, a compass, food, a weapon. He doesn't speak the language. He doesn't even know the rest of the plan because they wouldn't tell him anything else. So there he is on his own, and he really has no other choice. He can't climb back over. They'll shoot him, and he has to go on by himself.
And this is just the prologue of the story. And so we go back and learn more about Churchill's life leading up to that point. And what had his military service been like up to the Second Boer War?
So Churchill had always been fascinated by war. Even as a child, he had 1,500 toy soldiers. He was a direct descendant of the first Duke of Marlborough, who is considered to be one of Britain's greatest generals. And it had always been a part of his life. And as he grew older, he thought of it as his vehicle to recognition, to fame, and then eventually to political power. He called it the glittering gateway to distinction. And so this is the height of the British Empire. The Great Britain ruled, 450 million people, about a quarter of the world's population. And so because of that, they were constantly putting down revolts everywhere from Egypt to Ireland. And so Churchill could really take his pick of what wars he wanted to fight in. And he always chose the most brutal battles that were available, and he threw himself into them. And he wanted not only to be brave, but to be seen being brave. And so he would do these crazy things, like he rode a white pony on the battlefield in British India. So again and again, he put himself at great, great peril. And, he nearly was killed many times. He killed men himself. And he watched his friends not just killed, but mutilated. By the time he gets to South Africa, he's only 24 years old. This is his fourth war on three different continents. He understands war very well.
Well, and there's the famous quote, to be fired upon without result is one of the most invigorating feelings in the world.
That's right. Exactly. And he, he's a young man. He believes he's destined for greatness. And he, even though he sees his friends dying around him, he doesn't believe that will be his fate. He tells his mom that he doesn't believe the gods would create so potent a being as himself for so prosaic an ending.
And you could almost say that it's delusions of grandeur, but he achieved so much in his life that he was almost right on scale there.
Yes. Again, I think there are a lot of young men, especially, who believe great things of themselves. The difference with Churchill is he made it happen. Even though he was born into the highest ranks of the British aristocracy, he didn't sit around waiting for things to happen to him. He looked for opportunities and he threw himself into these opportunities. And again, he's 24 years old. Not only has he been in four wars, he's already written three books and run for parliament and lost, but he has this boundless ambition.
Do you think that search for glory in battle was for itself, or was it to further his political career?
I think it's both, but I think it's mostly to further his political career. I mean, he was very practical, and he knew that this was really his way of getting where he wanted to go. And that's why, his mother was American, actually, and she was this famous beauty, and she had all these connections to very powerful people. And so he told her, he said, look, this is a pushing age. We must push with the best. And so he kept asking her to help him get appointments to regiments in all these different battles, because he believed, and it turns out he was right, this is a way to get recognized, to become famous, and to use that to win a seat in Parliament.
And for fans of Downton Abbey, his mother and even his grandmother were what they called dollar princesses.
That's right.
American women who had a lot of money that married into the aristocracy.
That's right. So Churchill was born in Blenheim Palace, which is this incredibly enormous, opulent palace that even his mother, who was wealthy, who was raised sort of in luxury, was sort of dumbfounded when she first saw it. But like most of those huge estates at that time, it was struggling, and the previous dukes, his father had been the son of the seventh duke, the third son of the seventh duke, were selling things desperately to try to stay afloat, selling the gems, selling the library, the paintings. And so what they started doing then, as you said, is marrying these dollar princesses. Now, Churchill's mother didn't exactly fit into that category because her father had lost as many fortunes as he had won. And I think his parents truly had fallen in love because she was really this extremely beautiful, intelligent, charming woman.
Now, his father was almost as ambitious and successful as his son, but his political star ascended very quickly and exploded very quickly.
Yes, that's right. He had risen very high, very quickly, as you said, Chancellor of the Exchequer, just one position below the Prime Minister, had believed, as had everyone, that he would be Prime Minister himself one day, but had sort of you know, out of ego and misled ambition, had thrown himself off the top of the ladder, as his assistant said, because he had been insulted by something that had gone on, and he had put in his resignation, thinking that the prime minister would never accept it, but he did. And that was it, because a few years after that, he became very, very ill. Everyone thought he would come back and make, you know, a roaring return to political power, but instead he became very, very ill and died this public, tragic death at just 45 that was extremely painful for his son Winston to watch.
Churchill's career, Winston Churchill's career, was not only for his own aggrandizement, mm-hmm. also to restore the family name in a way.
I believe that it was. You know, he admired both of his parents very much and loved them, but always it was a painful subject for him, I think, because his parents didn't have time for him when he was young. You know, his father was extremely busy with his political career and very, very harsh when it came to his son. His letters to his son were very harsh. And his mother was busy with her social life. And Churchill was put in a boarding school at age 7 and begged and begged his parents to visit him. And they just never did. So I think that he wished that he could have been closer to his parents. And I think especially his father, you know, he said later in life that he wished he had been born a shopkeeper's son, because he would have learned something very useful and he would have had a chance to get to know his father, which would have been a joy to him.
And it was also around this time that he is looking toward romance and finding a suitable marriage partner for himself. And back in the day, it seemed like engagements would fall through so frequently.
Right, right. And so he was in India, wanting to fight in British India, and is sort of stuck in Bangalore, frustrated, looking for opportunity. And he meets this beautiful young woman, Pamela Plowden, whose father is a very high-ranking official in the British military. And he falls in love with her, and he writes to his mother that she's the most beautiful girl he's ever met. And they have this love affair, and he wants to marry her, but Pamela's father won't allow the marriage because he doesn't think that Churchill will amount to anything, which I find particularly delicious. But interestingly, they continue to write, even though Pamela goes on to marry somebody else, and obviously eventually Churchill does as well. But they have a friendship that lasts for the rest of their lives. Their letters span 65 years, some of the, as you might imagine, most tumultuous, fascinating times in the history of the 20th century. So it's a very interesting relationship that starts very early in Churchill's life.
And where do you think Churchill's devotion to writing came from? Why was he so compelled to write and share with people that way?
Well, he was an extraordinarily skilled writer. And I think a lot of it, and he credits a lot of it, goes back to the fact that he actually wasn't a very good student. And he makes more of that than is probably true. But the fact is that he was often at the bottom of his form. And they didn't think that he was bright enough to be put into the Greek and Latin classes. So they stuck him in the sort of, you know, common English class. But what happened is that he had a great teacher, a teacher who taught him the English language. And so he had an incredible understanding of his own language. And he understood that it was this powerful tool and eventually a powerful weapon. And it also was his means of supporting himself. You know, he didn't have any income. He didn't have any money when he left the military. That was the only job he had ever been trained for, the only job he had ever had. And then he loses his first run for parliament. So this is how he supports himself, by being a journalist. Every war he encountered, he covered sort of the beginnings of the Spanish-American War in Cuba. He covered fighting in British India. He covered fighting in the Sudan, both of those while he was a combatant. And that's how he ends up going to South Africa, is as a journalist. And he's a very, very sought-after journalist. When the war breaks out, all these newspaper publishers reach out to him, wanting him to write for them, because they know, you know, he's incredibly intrepid. He gets the story before anybody else. His analysis is fantastic. He understands war. And his prose is absolutely beautiful. So he's able to parlay these offers into an incredible salary. He ends up going to South Africa as the highest paid correspondent England has ever had.
As you said, he has no income of his own through the family land, mm-hmm. but he does have a taste for the finer things in life.
Yeah. Yes, he does. So he thinks, of course, I'm going to risk my life in war, but why be uncomfortable while I'm at it, right? And So when he's sort of getting ready to go off to war and he's getting all the things that you would think that somebody would need when they're going to war, he's also buying all these this incredible slew of like fine wines. And I think it's something like 18 bottles of 10-year-old Scotch whiskey and, you know, this beautiful compass and all these just like the most beautifully crafted things that you could possibly imagine. And of course, he has to take his valet with him. Of course, it wouldn't be civilized to go to war without your valet.
And so he goes to South Africa, the southern part of Africa. There is no mm-hmm. Republic of South Africa or even colony of South Africa at that point. As a reporter, although he had served in the military prior, it seemed very confusing how commissions in the military went, especially for officers. It almost seems like they came and went at will.
Right. So you could ask to be put in a regiment that's fighting somewhere you're interested in. But what's most interesting for him is the fact that in the past, he had been able to do both, be a correspondent and a combatant. In fact, the military had had to develop a rule that you can no longer do that because of Winston Churchill, because he was so openly and fiercely critical of those in command, especially Kitchener, with whom he ends up having, you know, a long, very contentious relationship throughout his life. They really, really hated each other. So by the time he goes to South Africa, the British military has said, you know, no longer can you be both a correspondent and a combatant. You can be one or the other, but not both. Because of Winston Churchill, they established this rule. And you'll see later on in the story, they end up breaking that rule just for him. You know, leave it to Churchill.
Now, Britain and the Boers had fought once before, about 19 years prior. What was the casus belli? What was the cause mm-hmm. of war for the Second Boer War?
So if I could talk a little bit about the Boers, just to understand what's going on here. So the Boers were these largely Dutch, German, and Huguenot immigrants who had been in South Africa for centuries and deeply religious, unabashedly racist, and stubbornly independent. Most of all, they just wanted to be left alone. So when the British Empire had abolished slavery in 1833, they just a couple of years later decided to get away from the British Empire. So they left Cape Town, which was Cape Colony, a British colony, and they moved hundreds of miles into the African interior on what they called the Great Trek. And they established three of their own republics at that time, one of which was a Transvaal, also known as a South African Republic. And unfortunately for them, they found both gold and diamonds in the Transvaal. And Paul Kruger, who would be president during the Boer War, said that this gold will cause our country to be soaked in blood. And he was right. So that obviously caught the attention of the British Empire. And the British Empire was interested in this area anyway, because they had to constantly go around it to get to India. It was a great place to stop and get supplies and rest. And then with the discovery of gold and diamonds, they were even more interested. So they had gone to war soon after the discoveries in 1880, and that was the first Boer War. To their shock, complete shock and horror, they had lost that war. It had been a very quick win, and they had never gotten over it and always felt like they needed to avenge that. Their interest had not changed in that area. They still wanted this land, and the Boers still insisted on their independence. So over the years, it just became more and more tense. Building and building and building. The British began amassing troops at the Transvaal borders, cutting the Boers off from the sea. And finally, the Boers had enough. And they said, you know, stand down or prepare for war. And they issued an ultimatum to the British. And this was exactly what the British wanted. They wanted an excuse to go to war. And so they just let the deadline for the ultimatum pass with little more than a sneer.
Now we have this longer-standing colonial force of the Boers and a newer invasion, essentially,
right.
by the British. With the local people that were there, like the Khoikhoi and the Zulu, mm-hmm. how did they stand in relation to mm-hmm. all these battles between these two colonial forces?
Well, thank you for asking that question. It was really important to me when I was writing this book to tell the story to the extent that I could from the point of view of the native Africans. And I make that point several times, and it's an obvious point, but often it's not made, is that this was a white man's war over land that didn't belong to either of them. Obviously, this is Africa. People have been living there not for thousands of years, but for millions of years. And the Boers had sort of quickly decimated both the San and the Khoikhoi populations in southern Africa. Africa when they arrived centuries earlier, but had been at loggerheads with the Bantu people for many years. That's the Zulu and the Xhosa, which would be Nelson Mandela's tribe later on. And so they had been fighting, and it really had made the Boers excellent combatants. You know, they had learned a lot from the Zulu and from their generations of battle with the Bantu people. And so when the Boer War begins, both sides, the British and the Boers, make this agreement, this gentleman's agreement, that they won't involve the native Africans. But of course they do. They very, very quickly force them to be messengers and perform all kinds of roles. And then eventually they force them to fight as well. And it just gets worse from there. You know, the British at the end, they go in thinking this is going to be a couple of months. It starts in October. They think it'll be over by Christmas. And it ends up lasting almost 3 years. And at the end, out of desperation, the British, you know, resort to scorched earth policies where they're burning farms. And they develop the first concentration camps. This is the first time that term is used. It's the first time it's used on a large scale during war. And there are concentration camps just for Native Africans. And so they suffer greatly during this war.
The British, over the years, had not reacted well to kind of guerrilla warfare tactics. Mm-hmm. People that are able to use the natural country, they just don't mm-hmm. line up in neat rows and shoot each other and hope for the best.
Right.
And it seemed they were so reluctant mm-hmm. to adapt their fighting style.
They were. They had been trying to drag their military into the modern world for just a couple of years. In fact,
they just finally changed the color of their coats.
Exactly. That's exactly what I was going to say. You know, they called it the khaki war because they had only just finally given up those dashing, infamous red coats. And they hated these new uniforms. They said they made them look like bus drivers. And they just hated, and they hated covering their gleaming medals and their bayonets and khaki paint. But they were still fighting in these perfect, precise lines, you know, just served up for the slaughter. And the Boers, they were excellent marksmen. They had better weapons than the British, and they knew every nook and cranny of this field. And they had smokeless gunpowder. So they were this invisible enemy, and the British didn't know what to do with that. And so at the beginning of the war, they were losing huge battle after huge battle and scrambling and sort of desperately trying to adjust to this very new kind of warfare.
The mission in which Churchill is covering is an armored train
right.
mission, and it's very horribly ill-conceived. It was not a good plan at all.
Not at all. You know, the armored train, it seems like such a great idea. You know, it'll keep you safe. It's got these armored sides that'll repel bullets and shells, but it's actually just a disaster. The men in this camp where he ends up stuck. He's trying to get to the front. The front is Ladysmith. He can't get there. It's closed up under siege by the Boers. So he's in this little camp, and they have this armored train that they use to go out for reconnaissance. And the men there call it a death trap because, you know, it's the perfect target for the Boers because it's on this fixed rail. It's on these tracks. They know where it's going. They know it has to come back. So it's very, very easy for them to attack it. And that's exactly what happens to Winston Churchill.
And they were even running on a regular schedule.
I know. Yes, I know. That's really a nice thing, you know, if you're in the city waiting for your train. But if you're in war, it's not too bright. But, you know, Churchill's friend, Almer Holden, had been chosen to be in charge of the train to take it out on reconnaissance. He knew that it was a disastrous decision, but there was nothing he could do about it. I mean, not only was it an easy target for the Boers on the best of days, but they had just spotted the Boers outside of escort only the day before. He was really nervous about it, but again, he didn't have a choice. And he sees his old friend Churchill and he says, "Hey, I have to do this. Do you want to come with me?" Churchill has a choice. He doesn't have to go. He knows everything that Holden does about the dangers of this train, but he's frustrated, he's restless, and he would later admit he was eager for trouble. And so he doesn't hesitate for a moment to climb on board that train.
It's just the level of arrogance in the the high officer corps is unbelievable.
Yeah, it really is. But Churchill's right there with them. You know, I laugh because again and again and again when I was doing research, men would say in their letters and discussions that were recorded in newspaper articles, they would say, "You know, I can't stand that kid, Winston Churchill. He's going to be prime minister one day, but I cannot stand him," because he had absolutely the same level of arrogance.
Well, and his ancestor, John Churchill was an amazing general, probably the best of the British had at the time, but everyone hated him too.
That's right. Yeah. I mean, nobody likes an arrogant man, whether or not he's right. Right? But, you know, Churchill wasn't there to be liked. He was there to achieve something, which he did.
And so when the train does come under attack,
right,
Churchill becomes involved in the proceedings, and that does not save him from being a prisoner of war at that point.
It doesn't. And, you know, it's this extraordinary situation. So the Boers are watching the train, and they see it go by. They know it's going to come back the same way. So they go to the bottom of a hill. They pile rocks at the bottom. They go to the top of that hill. They wait for the train to come back, and they fire on it. And the train does exactly what they want it to do. It goes as fast as it can to get away from them. And so it goes speeding down this hill and crashes into these rocks. The first two cars are catapulted off the tracks. Men are killed and horribly wounded. They're under this incredible hailstorm of shells and bullets. And Winston Churchill is 24 years old, one of the few civilians on the train, jumps off and starts giving orders. He's running back and forth, shouting orders to everyone. And what's more incredible is that they listen. They listen to him and they do what he says. And even though this train is full of legitimate, uniformed members of the military, their commander is right there, Churchill's friend, Almer Halden. But even he is listening to Churchill. He trusts him. And I think that shows what he was, just this born leader, you know. And a lot of the men do make it out alive. And everyone who does credits Winston Churchill's resourcefulness and bravery for saving their lives.
It seems like Teddy Roosevelt would be similar in that. So have you learned from them, and in your everyday life, do you just kind of take charge when you need to? And
no, I do not have that personality, but you're absolutely right. I worked on this book for 5 years, and I kept thinking again and again how much Churchill reminds me of Teddy Roosevelt. You know, they were both incredibly arrogant, incredibly ambitious, unbelievably well-read, both beautiful writers, and both born leaders. And I think, you know, it's very telling because they did meet later on after this war. Actually, they met in the United States, and they didn't like each other. And I think it was because they're too much alike.
Two alpha males coming up against
each
other.
It's not going to go well.
So with the book about Teddy Roosevelt and the one about the Garfield assassination, what draws you to this kind of Gilded Age, turn of the century era to investigate?
Well, I love this era. You know, you mentioned Downton Abbey. I mean, I think it's common, you know, it's a very, very evocative, rich area where you feel like you can hear it and smell it and taste it, all those things that kind of put you in the story. But for me, as a writer of narrative nonfiction, I love the fact that you have access to a ton of primary source material. You know, you need so much that you think you can never get through it, that you're just drowning in it. You have to have letters and diaries and newspaper accounts and firsthand accounts so that you can have dialogue, so you can have a real deep understanding of the subject, and so you can have all those little details that you hope really make a story come alive. And so it's not that I thought, you know, I want to sort of limit myself to this period in time. It's just that there's so much to work with, and I keep finding so many great stories in that time period.
And Churchill, of course, wrote about this period in his life, and then
yes,
they had that collection of essays, what, from London to Ladysmith,
right,
via Pretoria.
Right.
In investigating it and looking at the other sources besides his own writing, were there any major inconsistencies that you found in his recounting of the story?
There really weren't. I was surprised because there are a lot of overlaps. Almer Halden wrote a couple of books about this experience. Brocky writes about it to his father. The men on the train, they're interviewed by newspaper journalists. They write about it. The men who helped Churchill as he's escaping, he ends up, you know, hiding in this at this colliery, they write about it. So again and again, there are overlaps. And, you know, a lot of times people think of Winston Churchill as being sort of this teller of tall tales. But in this instance, he really didn't. Everything he talked about was confirmed. I mean, there were disagreements. I mean, certainly Halden didn't appreciate the fact that Churchill got out with his escape plan and he didn't. And there were some, you know, hurt feelings and hard feelings later on. But as far as the truth of what he was telling, it lined up.
Now, when he is taken to Pretoria to be in the prisoner of war prison, this isn't Andersonville.
Right.
This isn't Bridge on the River Kwai. It's pretty posh digs for prisoners of war.
It really is. You know, the Boers bristled at the British Empire's belief that they were these backward, uncouth, uneducated Boers, right? They were always dismissing them. And so the Boers wanted to prove them to them that they were just as civilized. And so they went to extreme lengths with this prison. You know, they let these men have newspapers. They let them, I mean, Churchill had a barber who came in regularly to cut his hair.
And that's how they discovered he was missing.
That's right. It ends up not being such a great thing for him. I mean, he buys a tweed suit, you know, which also helps him kind of blend in to the population when he escapes in Pretoria. So they have all of these incredible privileges that you wouldn't assume that somebody would have as a POW. Now, when Churchill escapes, a lot of those are taken away because the Boers are humiliated and enraged, and they come down hard on the other prisoners. But when Churchill's there, it's not bad. That said, Churchill was absolutely miserable. He says himself that he hated his captivity more than he had ever hated any other period in his whole life, and he couldn't wait to get out and to be a free man again.
We won't spoil anything else about his escape and his eventual... He makes it.
That's right, exactly.
Obviously. But how far did this notoriety of his capture and escape carry him when he got back to Britain?
Very, very far. You know, the war was still going on when he returned to England, and he quickly parlayed this into an electoral victory. He ran for Parliament again, and this time he won. And he wrote to the Prime Minister at the time, and he said he knew that his victory was because of his popularity coming out of this war in South Africa. You know, the British Empire was shocked to find itself losing, and it didn't have a hero. It thought that Sir Redvers Buller, who was a commander-in-chief, would be its hero. They called him the steamroller. They thought he was going to roll right over the Boers. But he very quickly was pulled out because he was losing and losing, and they end up having three different commanders-in-chief. So they needed a hero. They needed just someone to raise morale, and that's exactly what Churchill did. You know, he performed this incredible feat. I mean, it's really just this stunning achievement by any standard. And the fact that it was the son of Lord Randolph Churchill, and the fact that he did it at a time when the British were horribly losing the war, all that caught everyone's attention. And when he escapes, he sort of disappears and nobody knows where he is. And they know that the Boers are scouring the veldt looking for him. They know that if they capture him, there's a very real risk that they will kill him. And so when he comes out alive on the other end in Portuguese East Africa, it's this huge story, and he becomes a national hero, and it absolutely launches his political career.
Now, they say in America, no one has had more books written about him than Abraham Lincoln. Does Churchill kind of serve the same role in England?
Absolutely. I think there are about 12,000 books written about Winston Churchill. They say more books about him than anyone but Napoleon and Jesus. And I think that's true. And as a writer, that's obviously very intimidating. Not only the number of books, but the quality of the books. You know, I think some of the most respected minds in history and biography have written about Winston Churchill. But I was so captivated by this story. And I felt that it was so revealing about Winston Churchill, the man. And that's what interests me in all the books that I write. You know, I think that often when we look back at the past, what catches our eye, what we remember, are those large public moments of triumph or infamy. But what interests me are the smaller private moments of struggle when somebody is sick or they're scared or they're desperate, because I feel like that's when you really see them for who they are. Their true nature is revealed. And that's absolutely the case here with Winston Churchill when he's escaping, because he swings wildly between, you know, incredible confidence and desperation. And at one point, you know, he wasn't a religious man, but at one point he prays for help and guidance because he's scared and he's desperate and he has no help and he has very little hope. And I think you truly, truly see him for who he was.
And you even see in the fashion of his day, he goes to a palm reader.
That's right. He does. Even though, as he said, he had faith in his star, he wanted to sort of take a closer look, make sure it was still on track.
In reading so much of his writing, I'm sure, in researching this, and some people say he's the greatest writer other than Shakespeare, mm-hmm. in England, did anything rub off on you? Did anything stand out that you could take from him stylistically?
I don't know. I mean, I think that every writer kind of has to be his or her own writer. It's like my husband and I always tell our kids, you know, be who you are, just be yourself. And I think that's absolutely true for writing or painting or really anything that you do. You kind of, you can't try to write like somebody else. It won't work. You won't be able to pull it off and it'll be kind of a disaster and you won't be happy. But I will say that I was blown away by his writing again and again and again. You know, if you look at, and I read many, many articles about the Boer War that were written at this time by many different reporters. It's not a stretch to say that Winston Churchill's writing was head and shoulders above anybody else's. He was just, even at this very young age, just incredibly skilled and confident writer. And obviously, you know, goes on to win the Nobel Prize for Literature. And that quality, too, you can see at such an early age.
And that early age, you look at the cover of the book and you see mm-hmm. him in his military gear at the age of probably 23 or 24.
Right.
And there was a movie with Sir Richard Attenborough when he was young. He went by Dickie Attenborough called Private's Progress.
Uh-huh.
And they just look so fresh-faced, and he looks so similar to Richard Attenborough when
right.
he was young at that point. And it's just amazing that he's doing all these heroic things
it
looking
is.
So fresh.
My father just looked at the cover. He said, look at him. He looks like a kid playing dress-up. And I said, you know, he kind of was. You know, he had gone to military college, and he had always dreamed of war and glory. And so at that point, it's still exciting and kind of fun for him. And I think you look at it, one of the things I love is that you look at it and you almost – I mean, I think it would be hard for most people to recognize that as Winston Churchill, because we see him, the Winston Churchill, who what he looked like during World War II, you know, not this kid with his red hair and his nice new uniform ready to sort of launch his own thin body into war instead of sending young men into war.
Now, of course, our election in America, presidential election is coming up. And since you've studied extensively the Garfield and then Roosevelt eras, of course, Roosevelt ran on a third-party ticket right. later on, and you had all these very partisan newspapers mm-hmm. at the time that were just essentially party organs. What do you see in the past that reminds you of what's going on today in our current election?
Well, I mean, I think that what you can say about politics in general is that it doesn't change that much. I mean, I think people are horrified by the tenor and tone of political discourse today. But you can certainly say I've said the same about it, you know, in 1912 and 1880, you know, in 1899. I mean, politics is vicious. And people, again and again, I think, are willing to make compromises that maybe when they started, they didn't think that they would. And because they have what James Garfield, the subject of my second book, called presidential fever. I think they had it then, and I think they have it now. So I honestly don't see a lot of difference over the ages.
And is there a topic that's caught your eye for your next project?
I have a few favorites. I have kind of three that I'm sort of hopeful about, but I just need the time to do the research. You know, as I said, I need a really strong story that can kind of carry all the other things that I want to talk about, the bigger themes and ideas. But I have to have a lot of primary source material. Until I really start digging in, I don't know if I'm going to be able to make it work. So I finished this book tour in November, and I'm looking forward to December and going into my office, closing the door, and just reading.
Well, Candace, I want to thank you so much for stopping by today. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you for having me. I enjoyed it.
Candace Millard is the author of Hero of the Empire, The Boer War, A Daring Escape, and the Making of Winston Churchill, which is published by Doubleday. I'm Stephen Ussery, and this is Book Talk.
Thank you for joining us today. Book Talk is recorded in the studios of WIPL in Memphis, Tennessee. If you have any questions or comments, you can email us at WIPLFM@gmail.com or write to us at Book Talk, care of WIPL, 3030 Poplar Avenue, Memphis, Tennessee, 38111, or call us at 901-415-2752. You can find information on upcoming tapings and broadcasts of Book Talk, as well as download podcasts at our blog, WIPLFMBookTalk.blogspot.com.
This recording of Book Talk is licensed under the Creative Commons Attribution, Non-Commercial, No Derivative Works 3.0 license for the United States. You are free to share, copy, distribute, or display and perform this work. But there are restrictions. Nothing in this license impairs or restricts WIPL's moral rights. Thank you for listening to Book Talk.